Chapter 35. I keep imagining that Rudolph Valentino is going to ride over the next dune and carry me away to his tent, said Lauren sleepily. She was sitting on the front seat of the Pierce Arrow, her legs curled under her, staring at the ocean of sand dunes that dominated the landscape. Keep looking, said Pitt. The Coachella Dunes, slightly north of here, are where Hollywood used to shoot many of their desert movies. 50 kilometers, 31 miles, after passing through Yuma, Arizona, across the Colorado River into California, Pitt swung the big Pierce Arrow left off Interstate Highway 8 and onto the narrow state road that led to the border towns of Calexico and Mexicali. Drivers and passengers in cars that passed, or those coming from the opposite direction, stared and gawked at the old classic auto and the trailer it pulled. Lauren had sweet-talked Pitt into driving the old auto cross-country, camping in the trailer, and then joining a tour around southern Arizona sponsored by the Classic Car Club of America. The tour was scheduled to begin in 2 weeks. Pitt doubted that they could wrap up the treasure hunt in such a short time, but went along with Lauren because he enjoyed driving his old cars on extended tours. "How much farther to the border?" Lauren asked. "Another 42 kilometers will put us into Mexico," he answered. "Then 165 clicks to San Felipe. We should arrive at the dock, where Al and Rudy have tied up the ferry, by dinner time." "Speaking of edibles and liquids," she said lazily, "the refrigerator is empty and the cupboards are bare. Except for breakfast cereal and coffee this morning, we cleaned out the food stock at that campground in Sedona last night." He took his right hand from the steering wheel, squeezed her knee, and smiled. "I suppose I have to keep the passengers happy by filling their bellies. How about that truck stop up ahead?" She straightened and pointed through the flat, narrow windshield of the Pierce. Pitt gazed over the ornate radiator cap, a crouched archer poised to fire an arrow. He saw a sign by the side of the road, dried and bleached by the desert sun, and on the verge of collapsing into the sand at any moment. The lettering was so old and faded, he could hardly read the words. "Ice-cold beer and food a mother would love. Only 2 more minutes to the Boxcar Café." He laughed. "The cold beer sounds good, but I'm leery of the cuisine. When I was a boy, my mother loved to make dishes that turned me green." "Shame on you. Your mother is a good cook." "She is now, but 25 years ago, even the starving homeless wouldn't come near our doorstep." "You're terrible." Lauren turned the dial of the old tube-type radio, trying to tune in a Mexicali station. She finally found one, playing Mexican music that came in clear. "I don't care if the chef has the black plague. I'm starved." "Take a woman on a long trip," Pitt mused miserably, "and they're always hungry or demanding to stop at a bathroom." "And besides," she threw in, "you need gas." Pitt glanced at the fuel gauge. The needle stood steady at a quarter tank. "I guess it won't hurt to fill up before we cross the border."
"It doesn't seem as if we've driven very far since the last gas stop."
A big car that was built 60 years ago with a 12-cylinder engine and pulling a house trailer won't win any awards for fuel economy. The roadside restaurant and gas station came into view. All Pitt saw as they drove closer was a dilapidated pair of old railroad freight cars joined together, with 2 gas pumps out front, and a neon EAT sign barely flickering in the shadow of the Boxcar Café. A cluster of battered old house trailers was parked in the rear, abandoned and empty. Out front in the dirt parking lot, 18 to 20 bikers were milling around a small fleet of Harley-Davidsons, drinking beer and enjoying a cool breeze that was blowing in from the Gulf. "Boy, you sure can pick 'em," said Pitt drolly.
"Maybe we'd better go on," Lauren murmured.
having second thoughts. You afraid of the bikers? They're probably weary travelers just like you and me. They certainly don't dress like us. She nodded at the assembly, divided equally between men and women, all wearing black riding gear festooned with badges, patches, and embroidered messages touting America's most famous motorcycle. Pitt turned the outsized steering wheel, and the Pierce rolled off the blacktop up to the gas pumps. The big V-12 engine was so whisper quiet it was hard to tell it had stopped when he turned off the ignition. He opened the suicide door that swung outward from the front, put a foot on the high running board, and stepped down. "Hi there," he greeted the nearest biker. A bleached blonde female with a ponytail, wearing black leather pants and jacket. "How's the food here?" "Not quite up to the standards of Spago's or Chasen's," she said pleasantly, "but if you're hungry, it's not half bad." A metal sign liberally peppered with bullet holes said self-service, so Pitt inserted the nozzle of the gas pump inside the Pierce Arrow's tank filler and squeezed the handle. When he had the engine rebuilt, the machine shop modified the valves to burn unleaded gas without problems. Lauren warily hunched down in her seat as the bikers all walked over and admired the old car and trailer. After answering a barrage of questions, Pitt lifted the hood and showed them the engine. Then he pulled Lauren from the car. "I thought you'd like to meet these nice people," he said. "They all belong to a bike riding club from West Hollywood." She thought Pitt was joking and was embarrassed half to death as he made introductions. Then she was astounded to discover they were attorneys with their wives on a weekend ride around the Southern California desert. She was also impressed and flattered that they recognized her when Pitt gave them her name. After a congenial conversation, the Hollywood barristers and their spouses bid goodbye, climbed aboard their beloved hogs, and roared off, exhaust stacks reverberating in chorus, toward the Imperial Valley. Pitt and Lauren waved, then turned and faced the freight cars. The rails beneath the rusting wheel trucks were buried in the sand. The weathered wooden walls had once been painted a reddish tan, and the lettering above the long row of crudely installed windows read Southern Pacific Lines. Thanks to the dry air, the body shells of the antique boxcars had survived the ravages of constant exposure and appeared in relatively good condition. Pitt owned a piece of railroad history, a Pullman car. It was part of the collection housed inside his hangar in Washington. The once luxurious rail car had been pulled by the famed Manhattan Limited out of New York in the years prior to World War I. He judged these freight cars to have been built sometime around 1915. He and Lauren climbed a makeshift stairway and entered a door cut into the end of one car. The interior was time-worn but neat and clean. There were no tables, only a long counter with stools that stretched the length of the two attached cars. The open kitchen was situated on the opposite side of the counter and looked as if it was constructed from used lumber that had lain in the sun for several decades. Pictures on the walls showed early engines, smoke spouting from their stacks, pulling passenger and freight trains across the desert sands. The list of records on a Wurlitzer jukebox was a mix of favorite pop music from the 40s and 50s and the sounds of steam locomotives. Two plays for 25 cents. Pitt put a quarter in the slot and made his selections. One was Frankie Curl playing Sweet Lorraine. The other was the clamor of a Norfolk and Western single-expansion articulated steam locomotive leaving a station and coming to speed. A tall man in his early 60s, with gray hair and white beard, was wiping the oak countertop. He looked up and smiled, his blue-green eyes filled with warmth and congeniality. "Greetings, folks. Welcome to the Boxcar Café. Travel far? Not far, Pitt answered, throwing Lauren a rakish grin. We didn't leave Sedona as early as I planned. Don't blame me, she said loftily. You're the one who woke up with Colonel Passions. What can I get you? Said the man behind the bar. He was wearing cowboy boots, denim pants, and a plaid shirt that was badly faded from too many washings. Your advertised ice-cold beer would be nice, replied Lauren, opening a menu. Mexican or domestic? Corona? One Corona coming up. And you, sir? What do you have on tap? Asked Pitt. Olympia, Coors, and Budweiser. I'd like an Ole. Anything to eat? Inquired the man behind the counter. Your mesquite chili burger, said Lauren, and coleslaw. I'm not real hungry, said Pitt. I'll just have the coleslaw. Do you own this place? Bought it from the original owner when I gave up prospecting. He set their beer on the bar and turned to his stove. The boxcars are interesting relics of railroad history. Were they moved here, or did the railroad run through at one time? We're actually sitting on the siding of the old main line, answered the diner's owner. The tracks used to run from Yuma to El Centro. The line was abandoned in 1947 for lack of business. The rise of truck lines did it in. These cars were bought by an old fella who used to be an engineer for the Southern Pacific. He and his wife made a restaurant and gas station out of them. With the main interstate going north of here and all, we don't see too much traffic anymore. The bartender cook looked as if he might have been a fixture of the desert even before the rails were laid. He had the worn look of a man who had seen more than he should and heard a thousand stories that remained in his head, classified and indexed as drama, humor, or horror. There was also an unmistakable aura of style about him, a sophistication that said he didn't belong in a godforsaken roadside tavern on a remote and seldom-traveled road through the desert. For a fleeting instant, Pitt thought the old cook looked vaguely familiar. On reflection, though, Pitt figured the man only resembled someone he couldn't quite place. "I'll bet you can recite some pretty interesting tales about the dunes around here," he said, making idle conversation. "A lot of bones lie in them, remains of pioneers and miners who tried to cross 400 kilometers of desert from Yuma to Borrego Springs in the middle of summer."
"Once they passed the Colorado River, there was no water?" asked Lauren.
"Not a drop. Not until Borrego. That was long before the valley was irrigated. Only after them old boys died from the sun did they learn their bodies lay not 5 meters from water. The trauma was so great they've all come back as ghosts to haunt the desert."
Lauren looked perplexed. "I think I missed something."
"There's no water on the surface," the old fellow explained. "But underground there's whole rivers of it, some as wide and deep as the Colorado."
Pitt was curious. "I've never heard of large bodies of water running under the desert."
"There's two, for sure. One, a really big sucker, runs from upper Nevada south into the Mojave Desert and then west, where it empties into the Pacific below Los Angeles. The other flows west under the Imperial Valley of California before curling south and spilling into the Sea of Cortez."
"What proof do you have these rivers actually exist?" asked Lauren. "Has anyone seen them?"
"The underground stream that flows into the Pacific," answered the cook, as he prepared Lauren's chili burger, "was supposedly found by an engineer searching for oil. He alleged his geophysical instruments detected the river and tracked it across the Mojave and under the town of Laguna Beach into the ocean. So far, nobody has proved or disproved his claim. The river traveling to the Sea of Cortez comes from an old story about a prospector who discovered a cave that led down into a deep cavern with a river running through it. Pitt tensed as Yeager's translation of the quipu suddenly flashed through his mind. This prospector, how did he describe this underground river? The diner's owner talked without turning from his stove. His name was Lee Hunt, and he was probably a very inventive liar. But he swore up and down that back in 1942 he discovered a cave in the Castle Dome Mountains not too far northeast of here. From the mouth of the cave, through a chain of caverns, he descended 2 kilometers deep into the earth until he encountered an underground river rushing through a vast canyon. It was there, Hunt claims, he found rich deposits of placer gold.
I think I saw the movie, said Lauren, skeptically.
The old cook turned and waved a spatula in the air. People at the assay office stated that the sand Hunt carried back from the underground canyon assayed at $3,000 per ton. A mighty good recovery rate when you remember that gold was only $20.65 an ounce back then.
Did Hunt ever return to the canyon and the river? Asked Pitt.
He tried, but a whole army of scavengers followed him back to the mountain, hungering for a piece of the River of Gold, as it became known. He got mad and dynamited a narrow part of the passage about 100 meters inside the entrance. Brought down half the mountain. Neither Hunt nor those who followed him were ever able to dig through the rubble or find another cave leading inside.
With today's mining technology, said Pitt, re-excavating the passage should be a viable project.
Sure, if you want to spend about $2 million, snorted the cook. Nobody I ever heard about was willing to gamble that much money on a story that might be pure hokum.
He paused to set the chili burger and coleslaw dishes on the counter. Then he drew a mug of beer from a tap, walked around the bar, and sat down on a stool next to Pitt.
They say old Hunt somehow made it back inside the mountain, but never came out. He disappeared right after he blew the cave and was not seen again. There was talk that he found another way inside and died there. A few people believe in a great river that flows through a canyon deep beneath the sands, but most think it's only another tall tale of the desert.
Such things do exist, said Pitt.
A few years ago, I was on an expedition that found an underground stream.
Somewhere in the desert southwest? Inquired the cook.
No, the Sahara. It flowed under a hazardous waste plant and carried pollutants to the Niger River, and then into the Atlantic, where it caused a proliferation of red tides. The Mojave River north of here goes underground after running above the surface for a considerable distance. Nobody knows for certain where it ends up.
Between bites of the chili burger, Lauren asked, You seem convinced that Hunt's River flows into the Sea of Cortez. How do you know it doesn't enter the Pacific off California?
Because of Hunt's backpack and canteen. He lost them in the cave, and they were found 6 months later, having drifted up on a beach in the Gulf.
Don't you think that's highly improbable? The pack and canteen could have belonged to anyone. Why would anyone believe they were his?
Lauren questioned the cook as if she was sitting on a congressional investigation committee. I guess because his name was stenciled on them.
The unexpected obstacle did not deter Lauren. She simply sidestepped it. There could be a good 20 or more logical explanations for his effects being in the Gulf. They could have been lost or thrown there by someone who found or stole them from Hunt. Or more likely, he never died in the cave and dropped them from a boat himself.
Could be he lost them in the sea, admitted the cook, but then how do you explain the other bodies?
Pitt looked at him.
What other bodies?
A fisherman who disappeared in Lake Kokopa, replied the cook in a hushed voice, as if he was afraid of being overheard. And the 2 divers that vanished into Satan's Sink. What was left of their bodies was found floating in the Gulf.
And the Desert Telegraph sends out another pair of tall tales, suggested Lauren dryly. The cook held up his right hand.
God's truth, you can check the stories out with the sheriff's department.
Where are the sink and lake located? Asked Pitt.
Lake Kokopa, the spot where the fisherman was lost, is southeast of Yuma. Satan's sink lies in Mexico at the northern foot of the Sierra El Mayor Mountains. You can draw a line from Hunt's Mountain through Lake Kokopa and then Satan's sink right into the Sea of Cortez.
Lauren continued the interrogation.
Who's to say they didn't drown while fishing and diving in the Gulf?
The fisherman and his wife were out on the lake for the better part of the day when she wanted to head back to their camper to start dinner. He rowed her ashore and then continued trolling around the lake. An hour later, when she looked for him, all she could see was his overturned boat. 3 weeks later, a water skier spotted his body floating in the Gulf 150 kilometers from the lake.
I'm more inclined to believe his wife did him in, dumped his remains in the sea, and threw off suspicion by claiming he was sucked into an underground waterway.
What about the divers? Pitt queried.
Not much to tell. They dove into Satan's sink, a flooded pool in an earthquake fault, and never came out. A month later, battered to a pulp, they were also pulled out of the Gulf.
Pitt stabbed a fork at his coleslaw, but he was no longer hungry. His mind was shifting gears.
Do you happen to know approximately where Hunt's gear and the bodies were found?
I haven't made a detailed study of the phenomena, answered the diner's owner, staring thoughtfully at the heavily scarred wooden floor. But, as I recollect, most of them were found in the waters off Punta El Macharo.
What part of the Gulf would that be?
On the western shore. Macharo Point, as we call it in English, is 2 or 3 kilometers above San Felipe.
Lauren looked at Pitt. Our destination.
Pitt made a wry smile. Remind me to keep a sharp eye for dead bodies.
The cook finished off his beer.
You folks heading for San Felipe to do a little fishing?
Pitt nodded.
I guess you might call it a fishing expedition.
The scenery ain't much to look at once you drop below Mexicali. The desert seems desolate and barren to most folks, but it has countless paradoxes. There are more ghosts, skeletons, and myths per kilometer than any jungle or mountains on Earth. Keep that in mind, and you'll see them as sure as the Irish see leprechauns.
We'll keep that in mind, Lauren said, smiling, when we cross over Lee Hunt's underground river of gold.
Oh, you'll cross it all right, said the cook. The sad fact is you won't know it.
After Pitt paid for the gas and the meal, he went outside and checked the Pierce Arrow's oil and water. The old cook accompanied Lauren onto the dining car's observation platform. He was carrying a bowl of carrots and lettuce.
Have a good trip, he said cheerfully.
Thank you.
Lauren nodded at the vegetables.
Feeding a rabbit?
No, my burro. Mr. Periwinkle is getting up there in age and can't graze too well on his own.
Lauren held out her hand.
It's been fun listening to your stories, Mr.
Cussler. Clive Cussler. Mighty nice to have met you, ma'am.
When they were on the road again, the Pierce Arrow and its trailer smoothly rolling toward the border crossing, Pitt turned to Lauren. For a moment there, I thought the old geezer might have given me a clue to the treasure site.
You mean Yeager's far-out translation about a river running under an island?
It still doesn't seem geologically possible.
Lauren turned the rearview mirror to reapply her lipstick. If the river flowed deep enough, it might conceivably pass under the Gulf.
Maybe, but there's no way in hell to know for certain without drilling through several kilometers of hard rock.
You'll be lucky just to find your way to the treasure cavern without a major excavation.
Pitt smiled as he stared at the road ahead.
He could really spin the yarns, couldn't he?
The old cook?
He certainly had an active imagination.
I'm sorry I didn't get his name.
Lauren settled back in the seat and gazed out her window as the dunes gave way to a tapestry of mesquite and cactus.
He told me what it was.
And?
It was an odd name.
She paused, trying to remember. Then she shrugged in defeat.
Funny thing. I've already forgotten it.